Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to today's program at the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Dr. David Okola. I'm a member of the club's Personal Growth Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our radio listeners, and we invite our audiences to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now, it is my pleasure and honor as being the chairperson of the Personal Growth Forum to introduce our distinguished speaker. Sir Ken Robinson will identify the elements and point the element, the point where the activities people enjoy are naturally and are naturally good at come together. Covering topics like power of creativity, circles of influence, and attitude and aptitude, Robinson emphasizes the importance of nurturing talent along with gaining an understanding of how talent expresses itself differently in everyone. Please help me welcome Sir Ken Robinson.
Thank you, David. Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. I feel a bit overshadowed, honestly, given that your next speaker has been dead. I mean... yeah, really. Also, the chicken jokes made me feel bad, I have to say, but... So I can't compete with that. I've been alive all the time, really, and... So I can only talk about this life and and think optimistically about whether there may be another one. So thank you for coming, particularly in the middle of the day in San Francisco, and to listen to some things about this book, The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. I was asked recently how long did it take me to write this book? And, you know, there are a couple of answers. One of them is... about a year, on and off, you know, with 6 months intensive writing where I was irritable and wouldn't speak to anybody, and the house was cleaner than it had ever been. But really, it's taken me, I suppose, about 40 years to write this book. What I mean by that is the book, to me, is about ideas that have impelled me most of my life. And a couple in particular, one of them is that I've always been struck by the fact that most adults seem to have no idea what their real talents are, what their genuine talents might be. I've lost track of the number of adults I've met. Actually, that's it. I have lost track of the numbers of adults I've met. But particularly the adults I've met who have no... real belief that they have strong natural talents and often think they're not really good at anything. And I have never believed that. My conviction, my life experience, this life anyway, has always been predicated on the idea that we all have profound natural talents and abilities. And I've never found it contradicted. I know people who've gone to work in really hard and difficult schools and have produced miraculous results with kids who are thought to be on the scrap heap. There was a great teacher I knew in England in the 80s, I'm sorry, who ran a dance program. Her name was Nadine Senior, and she went to a really difficult school in the old industrialized part of Leeds, which is a big city in the center of England. And she established a contemporary dance program with these kids who were in gangs, they were fighting, you know the story. But this was a brilliant teacher and a brilliant program, and it transformed the lives of hundreds of children in that school who turned out to have, it seemed to the local press, extraordinary talents as dancers. Not all of them, but some, and they, in fact, set up a contemporary dance company eventually called Phoenix Dance. It was one of the first contemporary black dance companies in England. And it tours all over the place now. They have alumni who come back and teach at the school. And I think a lot of people kind of mystified, you know, how was it that, you know, Nadine had this intuition that all this dance talent had aggregated on this housing estate in Leeds? And, of course, it hadn't. It was there anyway. It was just looking for somebody to discover it and develop it. So I find that a lot of people feel that they don't have genuine natural talents. And an awful lot of people, in my experience, kind of get through doing things they don't feel a tremendous passion for, but they've kind of wandered into, for whatever reason. You know, their family, their parents, circumstances, you know, they might have been good at something. But not living lives that they find fundamentally fulfilling in relation to the work they do, anyway. And yet, I also meet lots of people who do love what they do and couldn't imagine doing anything else, who are, so to speak, in their element. And that's what intrigued me. You know, what is it to be in your element? I heard myself saying this. In fact, you can hear me saying it now, if you like. I shall speak to you across the void. That I can pretend to be dead, can't I? I mean, really. How do you know if I'm not dead? You don't know. I could be having an out-of-body experience, you know, couldn't I? No, I heard myself saying this, that, well, because I was saying it. That why would I miss myself saying it, you know? It's one thing other people not listening to you, but if you're not listening to yourself, that's a problem, isn't it, really? What did I say? I don't know. That people achieve their best when they do the thing they love, when they're in their element. And I thought, well, what is that? So I've written a book about it. I've given this some thought, which is why I've written the book, so that you don't have to. Do you want to come in, by the way? Are you trying to make your mind up? You like window shopping at the moment. You might... Okay, I'm going to be ready put down if you leave now. You know what I mean? I want to talk to you a bit about that, about what it means to be in your element. But before I do, to me, this is a really fundamental issue. In three different respects. The first is it's fundamental to our sense of personal well-being. That finding this thing that you are naturally good at, which is one of the features of the element, to me, is transformative in people's lives. It gives them a different sense of purpose, a different sense of direction. And it's therefore a powerful personal argument or an individual argument. I don't mean it necessarily makes you a nicer person, that people want to see you more often or hang out with you. I used to work a lot in the arts and education. I'm passionate about the arts and education. And people always used to say to me, you know, the arts are really important. I say, why? I mean, I think they are. I said, but why? And they said, well, because they make people more aware, more sensitive, you know, more socially kind of cooperative. And I think, really? Where are the role models for this? You know what I mean? Really, if you look at the history of the arts and people in contemporary arts practice, are these groovy people necessarily that you want to hang out with them? Not necessarily. You know, the arts are littered with their own fair share of lunatics and mad people. I don't think you can say that all this leads to some desirable set of social attitudes. That's not really the point. That's a related conversation. I'm talking about tapping into something in yourself that gives you a sense of deep fulfillment. So it's a personal argument. The second argument, though, is, to me, cultural. This argument bears on the health of our communities. And I think this is a fundamentally urgent issue that we should address. David kindly mentioned the TED talk I gave a few years ago. Have you seen this talk, any of you? If you haven't, I recommend it. I'm in it. And it's great. It's been downloaded, I'm told, 4 million times from TED.com, which is great. Except that my son the other week showed me a 90-second video of two kittens who seem to be having a conversation with each other. And that's been downloaded 17 million times. So I'm not getting carried away, you know, really. I'm a bit annoyed, honestly, because I spoke for 20 minutes, wringing these ideas out of my life experience. All I had to do was look cute for 90 seconds, you know, and four times as many people would have been turned on by it. Anyway, there it goes. But one of the other speakers at TED was Al Gore, who gave the talk that became the movie Inconvenient Truth. His argument is that there is a profound crisis in the world's natural environment. There is, I believe. But I believe there's an equally profound crisis, not in the world's natural resources, though there is that crisis, but a crisis in our use of human resources, that we have misused our own resources in the way we've misused and misspent the Earth's resources. And the fact that so many people aren't in touch with their real capacities is an example of that. And I think the analogy is exact. The social costs, the environmental costs, the economic costs of clearing up the mess of our waste of human resources is as profound and far-reaching as our waste of the Earth's natural resources. The benefits of getting it right are equally profound. And there are also commercial interests in the middle of all this who quite like the way we're wasting resources. But I'll give you an example. In California, where we are now, where I live, last year, I think it was, 2007, I think it was 2007, the state government, according to an article I was reading, spent about $3.5 billion on the state university system, the SU system, I gather. In the same year, same fiscal year, the state government spent nearly $9 billion on the state prison system. And by 2010, according to the published figures, spending on the correctional system will exceed all spending on higher education in the state of California. Does that make any kind of sense? Does it answer to any intuition about human nature that there are three times as many miscreants around as potential college graduates? You know, three times as many criminals as graduates. And I know the two communities overlap, you know, to some degree. But I'm not saying they're not exclusive groups. I know that. But I just don't believe it. I think it's a despairing conception of humanity. And you know, I don't think there are that many psychopaths, really. Actually, you don't need that many psychopaths, to be honest. Right? I mean, one goes a long way, don't you find, really? If you meet one psychopath, you know, that's a lot. You know, if you meet two in a day, that is a really bad day, honestly. But I think it's a despairing conception. But I'm saying it's an exact parallel. And the third reason I think this is so important is because we're living in times of the most extraordinary change and uncertainty, and also opportunity, economically and internationally. I think the inauguration this week, the week in which we're speaking, was the most extraordinary symbol of hope, don't you believe? This incoming administration, and particularly President Obama, seems to me, I think to many of us, to have a real sense of what needs to be done. And the what needs to be done isn't tinkering, it's transformation. That we're living in times of absolute revolution. And what happens in a time of revolution is the things that you take for granted turn out not to be true. I mean, I wish somebody had pointed this out to Wall Street 4 months ago, that things they thought were true were not true. The whole premise on which they were trading turned out to be faulty. Either they were deluding themselves or they weren't doing their job. But I think it happens in all sorts of places. It's easy to judge other people from the outside, but there are lots of things that we take for granted that we don't know that we do take for granted. And the reason we don't know we take it for granted is that we take it for granted. So a lot of what I'm concerned about is helping people rethink things about themselves that they may take for granted. But I think it's both personal, I think it's cultural, and it has profound economic consequences, because the whole future, not just of America or California, but of, I believe it's not too grandiose to say it, of humanity, depends upon our doing things differently from now on. The old models are clearly collapsing. And the new models have to be based on a very different conception of what we're doing and how we do it. I mean, for example, I was born in Britain in 1950. Like, I'll just give you one example of this. I know, by the way, you don't believe that I was born in 1950. I understand that. I feel the incredulity sweeping towards me. How can this be, you are thinking? He is so boyish, aren't you? I feel it. I feel it, and I sympathize with you. But I live in Los Angeles, you know? I've had work done. You know, what can I tell you? But I'll give you an example. You know, when I was a kid, we took it for granted that if you went to college and got a college degree, you were guaranteed a job. Is that correct? The idea you wouldn't have a job with a college degree was preposterous. The only reason you wouldn't have a job with a college degree would be if you didn't want a job. And I didn't want a job, frankly. I was, you have to picture this, really. I mean, this was 1972. You know, I was channeling Robert Plant. at the time. You know, I was big into Led Zeppelin. I had my hair down here, you know, leather jacket, you know, blue jeans. I was almost offensively attractive, honestly, at this point. And I decided that I wanted to find myself. You could do this in the 70s, do you remember? So I decided to go to India, where I thought I might be. And I mean, I didn't get to India. I got to London, where, in fairness, there are a lot of Indian restaurants. You know, and I hung out there for a while. But I didn't find myself. But I knew whenever I wanted a job, I would get one. I would just go back and get a job. Because at the time, a degree was a passport. It's not now. At the very best, it's a visa. You know, it gets you in temporarily. And the reason for this is the whole structure of the job market has changed beneath our feet. The old model is based on linear assumptions about education and its relationship to economic development. If you go to college, you get a degree, you're set for life. I speak a lot to Fortune 500 companies. I don't know one of them now that's impressed if a kid turns up with a college degree. You know, I mean, they're glad you've got a degree, but they don't show you the corner office, you know, and say, oh my God, the very person we've been waiting for, you know, come here, your people will be gathering shortly. You know, and the reason is so many people have got college degrees. So we have this tremendously linear assumption about how education works and functions. I'll give you the most extreme example I can think of this sense of linearity. And it's this. In Los Angeles, not long after we arrived here 8 years ago, I was doing a lot of work with LAUSD, and there was a paper in circulation at the time about early years education. And it was entitled, College Begins in Kindergarten. No, it doesn't. Does it? I mean, if we had more time, I could argue this. But it doesn't. You know, kindergarten begins in kindergarten, not college. What people become depends on what they do now. It seems to me the extreme example of this, that we're imposing college expectations on three-year-olds. It's an obscenity. You know, you just picture, you know, in L.A. and probably San Francisco and New York, young children are being interviewed for kindergarten at the age of three. What are we doing? You know, I mean, presumably producing resumes, you know, and sitting in front of unimpressed selection panels, you know, thumbing through these resumes, you know, saying, this is it. You know, you've been around for 36 months and this is it. You know, you've achieved nothing from what I can see. You know, spent the first 6 months gurgling from what I can make out. You know, what children become depends on what happens to them now. There's a fantastic guy who runs a children's museum, a children's theatre workshop in Dublin. And he said to me a few years ago, he said, you know, a three-year-old is not half a six-year-old. A six-year-old is not half a 12-year-old. What we become depends on who we are. And this is why I'm saying a lot of adults I meet aren't quite sure, because they've been diverted almost systematically from their natural talents, very often. And I think we have to stop it. We have to stop it for personal reasons, for cultural reasons, and because it doesn't make economic sense anymore. The old model is bust, and the future will depend upon using all of our talents in a much more holistic way. And I think we need to change metaphors. And I'll tell you in a minute how I think we should do that, but I'll just indicate this. If you look at the management chart for most organizations, whether they're schools or colleges or universities or Fortune 500 companies, they look a bit like a wiring diagram, don't they? You know what I mean? There are boxes and lines connecting it. It looks like a technical drawing. And you see people's functions and the hierarchies between them and how authority flows through the system. And it all conduces to the idea that a company, a human organization, is like a mechanism. People talk about their functions. And we're running schools on this basis. And I believe it's the wrong metaphor, that we have to shift to a more ancient metaphor of agriculture, that human organizations are not like mechanisms. Your life is not a mechanism. Human organizations are much more like organisms. They depend upon feelings and intuitions and relationships and values and purposes, none of which machines have, but all of which human beings have. And I think one of the great reasons that people are diverted from their talents is because we've built industrialized mechanistic systems of education with an old set of objectives in mind and an obsession with standardization and conformity at the very heart of it. This is why so many brilliant people pass through the whole of their education and never discover their true talents. Now, let me say, I have worked in education most of my life. I have trained teachers. I've worked in universities. I work with all kinds of organizations now all over the place. I have immense respect for teachers. I'm not talking about individual teachers. There are problems in teaching like in every other profession, good and bad. Nobody wants to do this, I think, as a matter of routine, but it happens systematically. It's not deliberate. It's systematic. And it's the system that needs to shift if we're to make any real headway with it. And that's about addressing the fundamental assumptions that underpin the system. So when I talk about education, and this is really part of what's in the book, but also human organizations, I'm not interested in reform anymore. This isn't about reform, it's about transformation. We're living in cultural systems that were developed in the 18th and 19th centuries, and we now live in the 21st century, and many of them simply don't apply. So we have to remake this system for the future. So let me say what I think the element has to do with this. When you say somebody's in their element, I think it means two things. The first is that somebody in their element is doing something that they're naturally good at. That's the first thing. It's about aptitude. You kind of figured out what this is. You see, I was never very good at mathematics at school at all. One of the people in the book is Terence Tao. Do any of you know of Terence Tao? He's a professor of mathematics now at UCLA. When he was two, Terence Tao taught himself to read from Sesame Street. At the age of three, he taught himself double-digit equations and taught the other kids who were playing with him the basics of mathematics. At the age of eight, Terence took a college mathematics entrance examination and got 97%. At the age of 20, he got his PhD. At the age of 30, he won the Field Medal for Mathematics, which is the equivalent of the Nobel Prize, and a MacArthur Genius Award for maths. You know, Terence gets maths, you know what I mean? Terence kind of got the hang of it, you know, in a way that I frankly have not. You know, give him a puzzle, he can sort this for you. There's an aptitude here. And I don't think any amount of hothousing me at the age of two would have got me to the Field Medal at the age of 30. Similarly, I worked out a while ago that I was given my first guitar round about the same time that Jimi Hendrix got his first guitar. You know, it worked out for Jimmy. Frankly, you know, I am still stuck on the opening chords of We've Got to Get Out of This Place by the Animals. You know, I enjoy it, but it's not a full evening, honestly. So I'd like to give you my second greatest chord. Here it is. I've been playing this now for 50 years. So it's about aptitude. That's the first thing. But being in your element is not only about doing something you're naturally good at. I know all kinds of people who are naturally good at things that they don't like doing. To be in your element, you have to love this thing that you're good at. And if you love something you're good at with a passion, that's the sweet spot. You know, you never work again after that, really. My brother was in a rock band, my brother Ian, in the early 60s in Liverpool, where we grew up. And I remember going out to watch the band. I was kind of in my late 20s, I guess. And they had a fantastic keyboard player called Charles. Brilliant. Brilliant keyboard player. And afterwards, I said to him, "You're fantastic there tonight." He said, "Well, great, thanks very much." He was rather cool, you know. And I said, "You know, we're over a drink, you know, we're just hanging out." I said, "You know, I'd love to be able to do that." And he said, "No, you wouldn't." Well, I said, "Well, I would." He said, "Well, you wouldn't, you know." And we went on in this way for some time, you know, so backwards and forwards for the best part of an hour. And I said, "What do you mean?" Because I wasn't being sociable. He said, "No." He said, "Listen." He said, "To be serious." He said, "I play like that, and thank you for the compliment, because I practice like 8 hours a day. I get up in the morning. I just play keyboard. I live to play the keyboard." He said, "I love this." He said, "To play like I do, you have to love it." He said, "If you loved doing this, you'd be doing it. If you loved it." He said, what you mean is you like the idea of it. I said, don't you speak to me like that. How dare you? You know. Get out of it. I'm going to be in San Francisco in a few years' time talking about you. You know, speak to me properly. But he's right, of course. What I meant was I like the idea of it. But anybody who really loves something has to be dragged away from it. And time changes when you're doing this thing that you love. You know, if you're doing something you're really passionate about, 5 minutes, you know, an hour can feel like 5 minutes. If you're doing something you're good at but don't like, 5 minutes feels like an hour. And this sense of time, of engagement, of being authentically centered on an activity that resonates with you is one of the indicators that you're in your element. So it's at least those two things. But there are two other things I want to come to. But let me say first that finding this thing, or these things, nobody's limited to one. I mean, it's not rationed. You know, is not necessarily a simple matter. The third feature of this is attitude. A lot of people I know who are doing something they love to do, and it's kind of changed their life, say they've been very lucky. You hear that all the time, and, you know, of course, I've been very, very lucky. Well, you know, luck is interesting. But it's an escape clause, too, you know, because to say I've been lucky lets other people who aren't doing the thing they love to say, well, you know, I didn't have the brakes. And it sounds like we're just a victim of circumstance. Well, you know, good and bad things happen to all of us. Randomness happens. Chance happens. But that's not what makes a life. You know, what happens to you isn't what makes your life. It's what you make of what happens and what you make happen as a result of that. There's a lot of really interesting stuff, some of which is in the book. There's a chapter in the book called Do I Feel Lucky? And there's a lot of research about luck. What it indicates is that people who describe themselves as lucky very often have a particular attitude to themselves, a certain sense of entitlement to something, a sense of confidence that, well, why wouldn't they? Or a more outgoing attitude, a willingness to pursue something, a sense of perseverance. And that people who say they're unlucky are often inward-looking and rather sour about their circumstances. Now, I don't mean to say this is all about the law of attraction. I mean, we can have a different conversation about that, or positive thinking. But there's something in that. We do know that we create the lives that we live in a very particular sense, that we create our own circumstances and then dwell in them. So attitude is a big piece of it. And the fourth piece is opportunity. You know, in the end, there aren't that many Bronco riders in the Arctic, you know. There aren't that many pearl divers in the Sahara. You know, it's also about finding the opportunities for this thing to emerge. And a lot of people we've got in the book actually had to change their circumstances in order to discover this passion. And there's a whole section of the book, it's called Where's My Tribe? And we have a bunch of people there, like Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan was born in Hibbing, Minnesota, and he had to get out of Hibbing, Minnesota to find himself. He had to go to New York and be among people who felt the way he felt about the music he wanted to make. You see this time and again, intellectual movements, artistic movements, social movements, people need to gather with people who are on a similar journey. And they may be in your hometown, that's great. It may be a group of teachers that you work with. It may be a group of writers. It may be a group of scientists. But on the whole, human achievement is fueled by interaction with other people's achievements. I don't mean you have to hang out in groups and drink. But even writers who write alone ordinarily have a sense of a constituency to whom they relate or want to distinguish themselves. That human creativity is stimulated by the community of ideas, and we all build on each other's. So it's about creating the opportunities too. But the real thing I want to say about this is this, that the analogy with natural resources is exact, and I think it's profound. In the world of human resources, our own resources, our own talents, are often buried deep beneath the surface, like they are with natural resources. They're not just lying around. You have to go looking for it. And a lot of the people I've spoken to for the book have tales to tell about how they happened upon their particular set of interests, the circumstances that made it happen, and then what they did after that. One of the people I interviewed for the book was Paul McCartney. That's it. I just want you to know that. You know, that I hang out, you know, with her. No, Paul McCartney went to school in Liverpool, actually the other side of the city centre to where I went to school. I didn't know him then, but his old school is now a school for the performing arts, and it's a fantastic place. Anyway, I got to know them a little bit during the creation of the school, and a couple of years ago they gave me an honorary degree. By the way, I recommend this highly. If you reach a certain point in your life, people start giving you degrees. It's great. You know the way you work so hard to get the first one? After a while, they say, oh, have another one. I say, okay. I've got lots, if you want one, by the way. I mean, there's... No, but I went back to Liverpool for this, commencement. And we followed it up. I started a series of conversations with him about it. And I asked him, Paul McCartney, you know, one of the founding members of the popular music group, the Beatles. I asked him if he enjoyed music at school. And he said that he hated music at school. He went through the whole of his education, and nobody thought he had any musical talent. Paul McCartney. He does, doesn't he? Do you feel? One of the other kids in the same music stream at the same time was George Harrison, the lead guitarist of the said popular music group, the Beatles. And nobody spotted that he had any talent either. So this one music teacher had half the Beatles in his class. And he missed it. Their talent only emerged when they discovered Elvis Presley and rock and roll and started to play out of school privately and met John Lennon, and they created a tribe. And their passion for music, not school music, but their music, is what really started to bring them alive. I often wonder, what would we have heard of any of the four of them in the same way had they not met each other? I know, you can speculate. But you can think of great groups of all sorts. Elvis Presley went to school in Tupelo, Mississippi. And there's a great documentary about him, by the way, called Return to Tupelo. Some friends of ours had a brilliant idea of going back to talk to his old school friends about Elvis's early days in Tupelo. It's a fascinating documentary. But it turns out Elvis wasn't allowed in the glee club at school. They said he would ruin their sound. Elvis. Well, we all know what heights the glee club went on to. Well, once they'd managed to keep Elvis out, you know. So what I'm saying is that human talent is often buried deep. And if it's not lying around or even obvious to you, don't give up on it. A lot of it is about putting yourself in circumstances and situations where it becomes more apparent. And some of the signals are you feel an affinity with this thing. You know, you feel in a way you're resonating with something inside of yourself. I say it's not always about doing the thing you're good at. A great friend of ours for years was a concert pianist. And she gave up playing the piano in her 30s. And I asked her why. She edited one of my first books. I asked her why she'd given up the piano. Actually, I asked her how she got to be a book editor. And she said she had been this pianist. And she said one day she was giving a performance in London at the Purcell Room. And she went out for dinner afterwards with the conductor. And the conductor said, you know, you were brilliant tonight. She said, thank you very much. He said, but you didn't seem to enjoy it. And she said, well, no, not really. And he said, do you enjoy it, playing? And she said, no, I don't suppose I do, really, no. She'd never really thought of it. And he said, so why do you do it? Why do you play? And she said, well, I suppose because I'm good at it. And he said, well, you know, being good at something isn't a good enough reason to do it. And she realized that what had happened was she'd gone through her life, she'd been born into a musical family, she showed an early talent for the piano, she was encouraged to play, actually required to play. She did all the Guildhall exams. She went to the Royal College of Music. She did a Bachelor of Music degree, then a Doctor of Music degree. And then she graduated from that onto a concert career. And said, nobody had ever asked me if I wanted to do it. I hadn't asked myself if I wanted to do it. It just became taken for granted. I was going to do it. And she said, I realized that I didn't want to do it. And at the end of that season, I closed the lid of the piano, and I had never opened it since. I said, what did you do? She said, well, I realized that what I want to do all my life, but nobody ever asked me, was work with books. I love books. She said, I love the literary world. I love the literary life. I try to write. I love being with writers. I love editing other people's work. That's the world I wanted to be in, and nobody would ever let me get to it. So she said, I was in my 30s, thought, it's time. And she said, you know, she's taken a massive pay cut But she's never been happier. And I suppose I ought to say that too. There's no guarantee, you know, that finding your passion will make you rich. Unless you're Warren Buffett, you know, in which case you're doing something you're naturally good at and have a passion for, you know, and it's to do with making money. But it's not all about that. You know, our societies depend on very many roles and responsibilities for which money is not the primary motive, though, of course, we all need enough of it to get by. This is about something else. And we know plenty of people. I think we've come far enough, you know, and heard enough stories to know that getting rich isn't the answer for most of us. You know, it's a chimera to try and pursue that path. So what I'm interested in, therefore, is what do we do about all of this? So the book is also about not just what the element is, but also the conditions under which you may find this. And part of it is about attitude. Part of it's about finding other people. Part of it's about recognizing it's not just about children, that this is about all of us at any point in your life, because life is not, in the end, linear. It's an organic process that we can pursue in our own way and at our own time. But education is a big piece of it. And I think that's something we all have to engage in more systematically. My impression of this is that public education, not just in America, but certainly in America, is now moving in very many ways in the wrong direction. When I came to America, my wife and I and our two kids, we moved here 8 years ago, and we were told that Americans don't get irony. Now, I'm telling you this because you ought to know. This is what people are saying about you behind your backs. People are wandering around Europe going, oh, they don't get irony, you know. Now, we've lived here for 8 years. This is nonsense. I know this is nonsense. We were told lots of things that we found out were nonsense. We were given a book by our relocation agent. It was called How to Behave in America. I'm sure that was the name, a little pamphlet. It's like a cultural guide, you know, some do's and don'ts. I'll get you, if you're interested, I'll get you a copy, you know, because it may help you socially if you're having a bad time. You know, this may have the answer. There's kind of troubleshooting guide at the back, you know. that's what I'm doing. It said things like, honestly, Americans do not like to be hugged. Seriously, it said this. Americans don't like being hugged. And we thought, okay. Well, you know, we're very huggy in Britain. So we thought, okay, we'd better not hug anybody. You know, so we were turning up to these social gatherings, you know, and people would come towards us and we'd stiffen with our arms by our sides like this. Don't hug anybody. We were like refugees from Riverdance, you know. Like this, for weeks. And then, of course, we realized it was all nonsense that you'd like being hugged as much as anybody else. So we now hug people at random in the street. And they don't like it, is what we found out. This is what we've discovered. But I knew for a fact that Americans got irony not long after I arrived when I saw the title of that legislation, No Child Left Behind. Because whoever thought of that title gets irony. Because that legislation has been leaving millions of children behind. And the reason it's been doing that is not intentional. No, this is a cross-party piece of legislation supported by all members of the House, or enough of them, to make it law. Its intentions are admirable. The problem is in the strategies that have been adopted and the fundamental assumptions that underpin it. And notably, the idea that to face the future in education, what we have to do is simply improve what we did in the past. And what we did in the past was designed for the 18th and 19th centuries, not the 21st century. And there are several ways in which this is true. One of them is that there is a hierarchy of subjects in schools, about which we might talk. But the other is this obsession with standardizing. Standardization is very important. You know, if I go to a medical doctor, I want some standardized tests. I do. You know, I want to know what my cholesterol level is compared to yours and everybody else's. I don't want it on some scale my doctor invented in the car. You know, I don't want to tell me your cholesterol is what I call level orange, you know. What? What is that? Is that good? I don't know. You know, I want to know. It's what you do with the information. What's happened increasingly in schools is the old industrial model has been reinforced primarily through the overuse of standardized testing, which have now become the purpose of education rather than an instrument of it. And I believe we have to move in the exact opposite direction in education, in our own lives, and also in our communities and in our organizations. And this is why, if you think of it, the industrial model the manufacturing model is based upon conformity and standardizing, always. But if you think of another field, think of catering as a field. In catering, there are two different broad approaches to quality assurance. One of them is standardizing, and that gives you the fast food industry. You know, so if you like fast food, or whichever area you happen to like, every outlet you go to of your favorite chain is guaranteed to give you exactly the same experience. You know, it's the same burger, the same bun, the same fries, the same chicken nuggets. Incidentally, what are chicken nuggets? Do you know? What are they? I have examined live chickens in vain for their nuggets, and they don't have nuggets, honestly. What are we eating? We don't know. You know, the same cola, the same everything. It's all horrible, in my opinion, and it's contributing to the biggest epidemic of diabetes and obesity in the history of the earth. But hey, you know, it's guaranteed. Now, the other method of quality assurance in catering is the exact opposite. It's like the Michelin guide or the Zagat guide in some respects. What those guides do, particularly Michelin, is they don't tell you what to put on the menu. They don't tell you what times to open. They establish criteria of excellence for international cuisine. And if you want to be in their guide, you ask them and they come and take a look at you. And people who understand this business take a look, and if you're good enough, you're in the guide. And the result of that is that every single Michelin restaurant is fantastic, much better than fast food, and they're all different because they're individualized and customized to local circumstances, local tastes, local produce, but to the highest international standards. And I believe it's an important model because in education, we've been sold the fast food model of quality assurance. And increasingly, that's happening in our corporations too. Accountability is all about standardizing. And actually, humans flourish best when things are personalized and customized, and standards are much higher as a result. So when I say there's a need to change metaphors, I think there is. I think we need to go to a different model, what I believe to be an organic model of growth. And I'll give you an example. I live now not far from Death Valley in Nevada. Death Valley is the hottest place in America. Nothing much lives in Death Valley or grows, and nothing grows because it doesn't rain. Hence, Death Valley. In the winter of 2004, something remarkable happened. It rained in Death Valley. 7 inches of rain fell on Death Valley. And in the spring of 2005, the whole floor of Death Valley was carpeted in flowers, as far as you could look. And people came from across the whole of America to see this phenomenon. Photographers, botanists, tourists, to see this thing they might never see again. What it proved was that Death Valley isn't dead. It's dormant. Right beneath the surface are the seeds of possibility, waiting for the conditions to come. And when the conditions are harsh and hostile, all of this life protects itself beneath the surface. And when the conditions are good, this life opens up to the possibilities that have been made available. Now, great gardeners know this. Great gardeners know that they cannot make any plant grow. Plants grow themselves. What gardeners and farmers do is create the ideal conditions for growth. And I believe we have to do this in our human communities as much as in the field of agriculture. That great teachers, great leaders always knew if you give people the opportunity, the confidence, the hope, and the resources, they will flourish in a different way. And I think that's been the signature shift into this administration too, by the way. What has Obama been doing but giving people a different sense of possibility and saying, we can't do this for you, but we can help create the conditions under which it may become more possible. And I think every teacher, every parent, every company leader needs to understand those conditions for growth. And it's about individualizing and personalizing but having a different sense of cultural possibility. So the book is about that. What are those conditions and how can we make them happen? I came across a great piece recently about Michelangelo. Michelangelo was describing the making of his statue, you know, the David. And in effect, he said, you know, I can't take credit for this. I did not create the David. I revealed the David. The David was in the stone all the time. My job was to reveal it. And he said, actually, it's easy. All I had to do was to remove the parts of the stone that were not David. And there it was. And I think that's true with many of our lives. We have to remove the bits that aren't really us and concentrate on the bits that are. And particularly if you work in education or you're managing other people's lives, that's part of what it is to give, not dwell on the negative things, but look for what may be positive in there and give them that opportunity too. Michelangelo also said something very interesting. He said, you know, the challenge for human beings very often is not that we aim too high and fail. It's much more often that we aim too low and succeed. And so part of the implicit plea of the book is to set our sights higher and to succeed, but to begin by looking at the things that we may be naturally good at, and then among those things, well, which are the ones that we would love to spend more time on? And the premise of the book is the subtitle, that if we do that, finding our passion changes everything. Thank you very much.
Our special thanks to Sir Ken Robinson for his comments here today. Again, my name is Dr. Oakland. I'm a member of the Personal Golf Forum, and I'll be moderating today's audience question period. We have a good amount of questions. Please pass your questions to the center aisle. Nora will pick them up. And the first question is, any thoughts on the difference between a passion focused on a physical skill versus a more cerebral skill? Or is everything a little bit of both?
Yes. Any more questions?
Yeah.
Let me speak to that very quickly. Let me ask you a quick question. When I talk about taking things for granted, can I answer this question?
Certainly.
Okay. How many senses do you have? Don't agonize about it. How many have you got?
Six.
Five. All right, five. What? Go on, tell me what they are.
Six.
What are they?
Visual, auditory, kinesthetic, touch,
yep.
Taste, smell, and feeling.
Feeling, okay. Do you agree with that? Any other words for feeling? Okay, that's often what we say. Maybe. Now, I ask you this because most people will come up with that catalog. I've given whole rooms full of people 20 minutes to think about this. And we often come with those five senses, you know, smell, touch, hearing, taste, and feeling or intuition. Now, there's a difference, it seems to me, between the first five and that sixth. Because it's obvious what does hearing and taste and smell and vision. If your eyes are damaged, your sight is compromised. There's a direct relationship. It's not quite clear what does intuition. You know, intuition is a kind of spooky sense that girls have more of, isn't it? We are told. I came across a great book a while ago called Culture and the Senses by a woman called Catherine Lynn Gertz, who's an anthropologist here in California, based on her work with the Anglo-Ive peoples of southeastern Ghana. There's a whole section in the book about this. And the book is called Culture and the Senses. They had never thought to count their senses. Interesting. These are not a primitive people. They're advanced people. But in the West, we count everything. That's something else we take for granted. We think if you can't count it, it doesn't count. Now, they had never thought to count them. But when they did count them, when she counted them for them, they said, in effect, well, what about the other one? And they said, well, she said, what do you mean the other one? And they said, well, like the main one. Why not? Why don't you have that one in your list of senses? Now, this is a sense that you have got. It's not some spooky thing. It's a physical sense that you can't deal without. Do you know what it is? I'll tell you. This is the sense of balance. Balance is an absolutely profound physical sense. It's mediated by the inner ear. If it's compromised by infection or alcohol, as it may be later today, you can't function. It's actually more important than some of the other senses. You can cope without sight if you have balance. You can cope without hearing if you have balance. But if you don't have balance, you can't cope no matter what. Now, we never mention it. And I think that one of the reasons is we just take it for granted. We've heard it said so often, we've got five senses, it's a closed question. But our conception of five senses comes from that great taxonomic enterprise of the Enlightenment where we were counting everything. And people counting it were just using their left-hand side of their brains. They were oblivious to that. They were in a body at the time. But physiologists will tell you have at least nine senses, real senses. And I'll leave you to figure out what the other ones might be. David.
Can you identify other clues, quote-unquote physical, that are connecting to your passion and your tribe?
Other clues?
Yes, other physical clues.
Well, I think part of it is the reason I mentioned the senses idea is because, to me, this is about seeing this holistically. You know, that you never can truthfully separate your mind from your body, not successfully. I mean, there are some things that are entirely, so to speak, focused on a certain type of intellectual effort, but you still live in a body. And if you become tired and fatigued and overwrought, that affects how you think. If you do something which other people may think of as a purely physical sort of activity, like gymnastics, it's also an intensely mental activity to do that. One of the people in the book is an extraordinary guy called Bart Connor, who is the most decorated male gymnast in American history. He lives now in Norman, Oklahoma. He's married to Nadia Comaneci, you know, the first perfect 10. I've talked to him often about the process of gymnastics. I worked a lot with the Royal Ballet when I lived in England. I find that this, what comes, whether it's an apparently physical activity or an apparently mental activity, if you're doing something which is resonating deeply with you, there's a different type of well-being that comes from it, you know, a different sense of composure. It's a sense of unity that comes from it. But people find it differently. You know, I've spoken to jazz musicians about how do you make the music. They don't really know. You know, but making music through an instrument, particularly one that all instruments rely on physical manipulation, is an extraordinary combination of emotional, intellectual, and physical dexterity. And to try and separate them out, it's okay, but it's not how it is. I'll give you one just example. I know I have to finish in a minute, a while ago, was at a natural history museum. And I was in a room that was full of butterflies. And it's a beautiful display, you know. There are butterflies in cases, pinned to the back, all dead. But, you know, the large ones at the top and the small ones at the bottom. The next room was full of arachnids, and there was a room full of beetles. Well, it's a way of thinking about it. You know, it answers to Linnaeus's taxonomy of genera and species, and it's a way of thinking about it. But when you go into the world, that's not how it is. You know, you don't see all these butterflies flying around in formation, you know, the big ones at the front and the small ones at the back, you know, and the beetles keeping a respectful distance over here, you know, and just keeping to themselves, you know, in rank order. This is a way of organizing our understanding of these things, but our frameworks of understanding don't correspond to the thing that we're trying to understand. So part of what I'm trying to also promote is a different sort of conversation about these things. You know, in the West, we tend to think that the way to think is to make distinctions. And there are equally honorable ways of approaching life which are based on seeing relationships and connections. And that's the heart of an organic conception, I think.
The next question, what is the single most important aspect of your book to finding your passion?
Buying it, I think, really is, I would say.
Very good. Next question.
Well, I'm dead serious about it. No, I think firstly that the book is, so to speak, a hymn to diversity. I find that, you know, when we talk about what we take for granted, very often what we take for granted are our own talents. You know, because you think, well, if I can do it, you know, anybody could do that. You hear it all the time. You know, just think about Paul McCartney, for example. Just, I don't mean to go on about it, but I didn't ask him this, but he was interviewed a while ago. I remember he was asked about how he wrote songs, you know, whatever you think of them. And he said, well, every day I wake up, I've got tunes in my head. I just assumed everybody did. He's kind of amazed that other people don't. Other people wake up with lyrics in their heads the whole time. Bart Connor, just to say very quickly, when he was 6 in Morton Grove, Illinois, he found that he could walk on his hands as easily as he could walk on his feet. We know, which wasn't much use to anybody, but, you know, it was socially entertaining. And then he found he could walk up and down stairs on his hands as well. And he said, you know, I didn't see any great point in it, but it was something I could do, rather like doing it. And apparently, you know, whenever the conversation lulled at home, you know, that said, Bart, just do the hands thing there, would you, for a minute? His mother, though, when he was, I think, 8, spoke to the gymnastics teacher at school, and they took him to the gymnastics center in his hometown. And he said he walked into this room, and for him, it was like a combination of Santa's Grotto and Disneyland. You know, there were ropes, trapezes, vaulting horses. He said, I couldn't believe how magical this was. He said it was intoxicating. Well, you see, there again, I don't have that feeling when I go into a gymnasium. You know, I want to get intoxicated if I go into a gymnasium. But he practiced, went every day, loved it. And 10 years later, he walked onto the mat of the Montreal Olympics representing America in the male gymnastics squad. And as I say, he's now married to Nadia Comaneci. They run this extraordinary gymnastics school in Oklahoma, and they are leading figures in the world Special Olympics movement. Now, my point about this is that it's about listening to yourself. We all resonate with different sorts of activities, and we often think, well, if I do, probably we all do. Actually, we don't. We all feel strongly about different sorts of things. Now, his mother had the wise intuition that this was important to Bart and who he was. What she could not do, of course, was anticipate where it would lead. All she was doing was investing in the moment. You know, it's not like she didn't think, well, look, Bart can do this, he's eight. There's this girl in Romania. You know what I mean? You can't put that together. What his life became depended on the opportunities that evolved in response to the talents that were developing within him. And that's what I mean by this organic thing. So I think part of this is listening to yourself and, you know, make some lists of things that you've, the times when you felt most comfortable, the things that have always excited you. And if you don't know what those things are, go out and do some more things. You know, put yourself in the way of things you haven't done before. You know, if you've never been to an opera, go to one. You know, if you've never looked at science seriously, take a look at it. You know, if you've never worked in teams of people, try that. But, you know, expose yourself to more things and begin to feel how they feel to you. A lot of this, I think, is like trying to discover your own true north. You know, you can't, in the end, plan the journey, but you can begin to get your sense of direction. And that's, I think, what accounts for many people saying that they've been lucky. What they've been doing is following their compass, and it's taken them through some very interesting terrain.
Next question. Besides writing, what other passions have you or will you pursue?
Me personally?
You personally.
Well, I suppose my passion has always been about trying to get to make connections. You know, I mean, I work a lot in the world of theory and practice and in policy, but I suppose from an early age, I've always been interested for myself to understand these things. You know, I mean, I didn't have a plan, truthfully. I mean, I don't think you do. I mean, some people do. But, you know, you come to write your resume, and then you impose a retrospective narrative on your life, leaving all the mucky bits out, you know, and make it look like some clear-sighted progression that was always apparent from when you left school. It hasn't been my life. I mean, for me, my life has been like skipping logs. You know, it's like, what's the next thing that came along? But then you compose this kind of groovy resume, and people think you had it all figured out. I don't know what the next thing is for me. But I suppose I've always been compelled along a certain path of a conviction that people are capable of much more than they found. And it's been born out of my personal experience. I mean, I could tell you more about it, but it's in the book. and time is running out. I understand that. But yeah, I mean, my life has been guided that way too, definitely.
Ken, we have one more question. And it's, if a college degree is no longer valuable, what do you recommend kids do?
Well, I don't mean to say that a college degree is no longer valuable. I hope I didn't say that. What I meant was, I hope what I said, is that it's not enough. It used to be enough. But actually, increasingly, it's not enough. You know, just to say, oh, I've got a college degree, you know that. A first degree is not enough. People need a higher degree. Or a doctoral degree. It's why people are staying in college so long. I mean, kids don't leave college anymore at 22. They stay until the mid-20s if they can get away with it. You know, or they go home again and start playing computer games. You know, because, no, and I don't say that cynically, because they're not sure what... It's a very difficult landscape for them now to work on. So part of my point here is that, well, it's twofold. One is, some people don't need to go to college now. That's somebody just going to college right now. People don't need to go to college always. They perhaps need some other life experience. Maybe they go to college later when they've figured out a bit more about themselves. I know hundreds of kids who are leaving college with not a clue what to do next. 4 very expensive years of life and of money behind them. So let's not take it for granted. And secondly, I think we need to look hard at our degree programs. You know, we need kids who, if they're going to go to college, who come out rounded and able to think for themselves and to deal with information in a different sort of way. These kids are living in the most data-driven environment in the history of the planet. And looking back to the old system simply won't cut it. And for some people, you know, they want to get off and do something else. They want to do very practical things right now. And they may, you know, they may go back to college at some point. I think the heart of this, though, if I can say so, David, I think is we have to get away from this outdated division between academic and vocational programs. You know, we have a world that's dominated by a particular conception of academic ability. And really, I think at the heart of it is a call to rethink that and then to build education systems around a different view of intelligence and of economic purpose. And I think that really comes back to this idea of helping people discover what's unique about them rather than just what they have in common with everybody else and standardizes. Let's celebrate the diversity that's inherent in being human and being alive.
Great. Please help me thank Sir Ken Robinson for his comments here today. For the title of his book, The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. We also like to thank our audience here at the club, as well as our radio audience at home. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 105th year of enlightenment discussion, is now adjourned.